Well, thank you, Andrew. It's nice to be here again once more. Well, this secular world we live in always likes to believe man has the answers to pretty much everything, from science, innovation, maths, revolutionary artificial intelligence that can perform just to our standard to resolve economic challenges, supposedly, or reverting man-made mess by another clever invention to assure people that the future is bright because our own intellect saved us once again. Except this is all wrong, isn't it? Well, let's step outside of that and meditate on things that keeps our minds healthy, like the appreciation of the natural world, especially at this time of year when the trees turn. And how some of us, well, I certainly anyway, admire the efforts of David Attenborough and all he's gone through to document the planet from remote corners of the deep blue, whether a pufferfish attracts mates, or the lady even, through sophisticated geometric patterns on the sand of the seabed without even seeing what he's making. Or that a fish can catch prey by invisible camouflaging or changing skin colours. Even the best thing I've seen in the heights of summer in Italy are swarms of bioluminescent fireflies. Well, what's the typical response? It's the admiration of Mother Nature, so people would say, and the gradual complexity of evolution's masterpiece. And why is that? Because in Romans 1 and verse 25, we're told, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator who is blessed forever. I haven't dived too much into context, but I can hazard a guess that this is the account of Israel in the wilderness, or it could be the state of first century Rome that had a very similar narrative. And even the text now is a damning account of where society goes when people become self as opposed to reverent God-fearing people. In verse 23 of Romans 1, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Well, climate activism is all well and good in saying we need to resolve and limit our environmental activity, but quite often it's all about believing biological science and astrology by means of pre-universal existence. That is our God and our creator. And so express a gratitude to their own consciousness, which says you fear the planet that you came from. Anyway, these thoughts are extracted from the end of Acts 12 when Herod is struck by an angel of the Lord. The people of Tyre and Sidon desire food, imports, and a time of famine, and ultimately peace from Herod's ruling territory in Judea. And so they're quite motivated to please Herod. Even so much, it came to his infinite wisdom to potentize royal robes, up his appearance, and give an oration so that the people praise him for having the voice of a god and not of a man. Well, there it is. Human nature to seek political resolvers and messiahs so much Herod took full glory for all of it. And what did God do as a result? Well, it wasn't shrugged off lightly. God takes great offense in the exaltation of man. If he asks Job for all the answers about laying the foundations of the world, then somebody like Job today with an Oxbridge Masters in astrophysics would dare to argue. And of course, man does on a daily basis. And I believe it would be a form of blasphemy. Well, Herod was struck down in Eden by worms, breathing his last. So a slow and gory death, and actually quite humiliating. The creatures of the dust consumed the present Judean king, perhaps raising his hands to silence the people and correcting their outlook by saying, "This is the Most High who rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he wills, and that God grants me power by his own grace." That would have maybe saved him from God's wrath. And by such terrible affliction, God is conveying that he is God and man are mortal and corruptible, no matter how proud or fine appearing they look. Would you labour night and day for an achievement, supposing you wrote a really good book or designed an intellectual masterpiece that changed society and even studied for years in the process, only to discover the fame and publicity is worshipping somebody else whose name dominated the title? You wouldn't merely shrug it off, you would be devastated and angered. Imagine being the creator of all comprehensible knowledge in life, only to find that that speck of dust you also formed of the earth is trying to be equal with you and captures the praise and influence of many foolish men. Is that not exactly why God made Adam of dust? To show the fragility and lowly value of humanity? How can we be like Herod? I thought to myself when swapping jobs a few months ago after application at a finely cut time before departing SSE through to each portal of information and success in qualifying for the new job. I thought, well done me. Absolutely zero assistance from anybody else. A feeling of achievement for performing independently. And it's a confession of wrong, but I did and had to remind myself that none of this was me. It was in fact God working to provide and paving the way forward. And with that in mind, maybe each of you can see where I'm coming from because you can relate to your own scenarios. We are very limited to what we can take credit for because, in actual fact, what we accomplish in life is God-given, be it talent or learning. What's our priority? To seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness so that all the latter and less important things may be in his care. Of course, there's a term used for how God reacts the way he does to Herod because, in actual fact, jealousy is how he felt. God's jealousy appears back in the Ten Commandments issued in Exodus 20 and verse 5. When God commands against idolatry, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. It is not that God is jealous or envious because someone has something he wants or needs. Verse 4 to 5 of Exodus 20 says, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or in earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Notice that God is jealous when someone gives to another something that rightly belongs to him. Why Herod? Because he places kings and rulers wherever he pleases so that peace and prosperity arises, especially as some in the last couple of weeks debate about Trump's Nobel Peace Prize recognition. It's God who stopped the war in Gaza, and through the active manifestation of politicians who he has appointed, and we know it will begin again, and perhaps the whole purpose is to test our faith, ensuring we don't fall for the idea that it's a peace that lasts in the region, as he claims. And when I wrote this, clearly it was ongoing, and now it's back to war. Give it time, Trump will resolve Sudan, perhaps, which has arisen this week. But it's so that we're not distracted by the praise of men rather than our sure hope for Christ to bring a certain peace. So there's a different sort of jealousy in Galatians 5 and verse 20. When we use the word jealous, we use it in the sense of being envious of someone who has something we do not have. A person might be jealous or envious of another person because he or she has a nice car or home, or of another person because of some ability or skill that the other person possesses. Another example might be that one person might be jealous or envious of another because of his or her beauty. And that's where, of course, social media lies to so many people who compare themselves to famous figures and say that themselves aren't enough. Whereas in front of cameras, even in the day when it was Marilyn Monroe, as a long time ago, so I'm told, it's just a well-known example, her image lied to her and in fact undermined what was more important, confidence, individualism and spirituality, which has much influence now. People can't cope with how it dissatisfies and in extreme circumstances ends their life. So towards Israel in Exodus, God is speaking of people making visible distractions and bowing down and worshipping those idols instead of giving God the worship that belongs to him alone. God is rightly possessive of the worship and service that belongs to him. It is a sin to worship or serve anything other than God, and we know that. It is a sin when we desire or when we are envious or we are jealous of someone because he has something we do not have. It is a different use of the word jealous when God says he is jealous. What he is jealous of belongs to him. Worship, service, these belong to him alone and are to be given to him alone. Perhaps a more relatable example will help us understand the difference. If a husband sees another man flirting with his wife, he is right to be jealous, for only he has the right to be flirting with his wife. And this is not exemplified commonly in the meeting, I'm pleased to say. But this type of jealousy is not sinful, rather it is entirely appropriate. Being jealous for someone that God declares to belong to you is good and appropriate. And jealousy is a sin when it is a desire for something that does not belong to you. Worship, praise, honor, and adoration belong to God alone, for only he is truly worthy of it. Therefore, God is rightly jealous when our time and strength is given to idols. This is the jealousy of the Apostle Paul describes in 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2. He says, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. And by context, Paul would be offended if the Corinth ecclesia are seduced by false teachings. And so that's why when he goes on to betrothing the brotherhood as what he says, a chaste virgin to Christ, that is to protect the teachings of the gospel and not to defile the ecclesia with false prophets. Because it says in verse 3 that he fears their minds may be led astray from a pure devotion to Christ. So on that note, what does Jesus say on self-gratitude? Well, it's worth considering the parable of the rich fool in Luke 12 from verse 13 to 21. And focally in verse 16, it says that it was the land of the rich man that brought forth abundance. The man seems to think that he is responsible for his wealth, but no, that's not true. It was the land that was productive. How did the land get productive? By God's hand, of course, by the blessings of fertile soils, the warmth of the sun, and the abundant rainfall. Which, as I interpret, partially expresses self-praise, but not entirely, and I'll come onto it in a minute. And perhaps Paul's Corinthians letter about church divisions in 1 Corinthians 3 verse 7, where he states, "So neither he who plants or he who waters is anything, but God gives the increase," is where he's picking this idea from, to portray that his teaching only sources and materializes from God. All blessings are from God and nothing to do with the rich fool. There's nothing we have that didn't ultimately come from him. The sense of this man's riches comes from his land, his estate, his property, nowhere else. Or James 1 verse 17 likewise makes the point that this is not the case. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. So when the fool sits down and contemplates his situation and his problems, he totally misses the problem he faces. He thinks it's all about not having enough space for his stuff. But that's not the problem at all. He misreads all the signs. He thinks he knows reality. After all, he's a successful man, isn't he? But no, he's just out of touch with reality. And much of this parable contrasts his unreality with real reality. The same is therefore true of the man who wanted Jesus' intervention with his family affairs. It's remarkable how self-absorbed he is, really. Note that in just three verses, from verse 17 to 19, he refers to himself 13 times. This is back in Luke 12. So 13 times he refers to himself. Talk about me, myself, and I. It's perhaps not something you realise until it's pointed out. Not only that, but his view of his soul is indeed soulish and not spirit-led. He doesn't realise that part of him is on loan from God. He figures he is in total control of himself, inner and outer. He thinks his total needs can be met by material things and pleasures he can enjoy. And there is an irony here, because he addresses his soul as himself, but the text here contains an ambiguous sense of soul, or psuche, which from Greek is our living desires. The connection here is Genesis 2 and verse 7, where God's infusion of breath results in man becoming a living soul, or nephesh in Hebrew. You have a God-given part of you which is on loan. It is what distinguishes you from the animals. So the rich fool then wrongly assumes that he has many years ahead of him still, doesn't he? Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. He looks forward to many years of plenty to spend on himself in selfish hedonistic pleasure. Take your ease, sit back, or better yet, lie back and enjoy the good life. Take things easy and spend all your wealth to pamper yourself. Eat, drink, and be merry. This is the soulish trinity of the hedonist. These three concepts have been found together in Greek language and also in English down through the centuries. They're combined to symbolize the ultimate in carefree, abandoned, luxurious living, focused on the pleasures of the flesh. And this man is selfishly considering spending all his wealth on himself. He figures that if he expands his barns and stores all his wealth in them, not just the grain, then he can live as he pleases until he dies. He doesn't give a thought to others. His thought is not to provide for others in famine or to share his wealth. He has no concern for God either. God just does not factor into this man's equation for what life should be. The fool, that's what God calls him. So Jesus does say at the start in verse 15 towards the latter that one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. But what is also being taught here is that the use of soul to satisfy oneself is just like Herod in Acts 12, because his rulership is just fame and taking from God that alone and materializing its glory for his own accomplishment. If God provides the grain for the rich fool, or the increase for whatever is sown, either spiritually, politically, or physically, then God definitely provided the same for Tyre and Sidon. There's a link back to Eden here too. In Genesis 2 and verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work and keep it. Well, that just says it all because the last two chapters just told us God created it all. Adam was just plonked there right after. He didn't make anything. He had nothing to tell himself how much he felt like he had accomplished. The best way to forward time on a weekend with the in-laws is a National Trust site. And of course, many people now visiting there believe it's a complex biological diversity that came from chance, forsaking the obvious design right in front of them and rather complementing the design of the garden and its beauty by the efforts of the trust. And as petty as it sounds, on the larger picture, when we think of this parable, it's two messages of self-gratitude and margining God out of his own work will come back on all now who believe. As an example, innovation is their own design rather than the fact they just discovered what God made all along. Or thanking scientists and praising man's efforts for making the world go round. All this, one day, God will judge likewise. Fool. Because in creation, and even your own mind, was my deposit that you should give glory in return, rather you had no praise for your creator. Jesus spoke this parable then, and he raised the dead, the blind, the lame. He, of course, changed the lives of many. In Matthew chapter 4, verse 23, it says, he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spreads throughout Syria, verse 25. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and beyond the Jordan.
Ooh.
He's spreading like wildfire, of course. Without even exemplifying too much, we know that in human weakness, you would think that on so many occasions, Jesus thought to himself how great he was and how admirable he was, that he could turn his miracles into a magic show for all the fame and the praise of men. Luke chapter 2 and verse 52. Jesus increases in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So when a man says to him, "Good teacher," what does he say in return? "Do not call me good, for one is good and that is God." And in John 5 and verse 30, "I can do nothing on my own. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me." Jesus didn't glorify himself, and even when it sounds like he is in John chapter 8, for example, "I'm the light of the world. Whosoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but has the light of life." Verse 12. Verse 18, "I am the one who bears witness about myself." Verse 23, "You are from below, I am from above." And there are so many confrontations between the high leaders and Christ in the Gospel of John because it's all about John's witness of the Old Testament fulfillment of the first coming of the Messiah to a blind people. So, verse 54, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me." So Jesus is telling them that he's sent to fulfill the law and bear witness of God's character so that the Gentiles who do not know the law can also obtain salvation. He could have glorified himself. If you go back a couple of pages in John 2, chapter 6 and verse 14, after the witness of the feeding of the 5,000, it says, "When the people saw the sign he had done, they said, 'It is indeed the prophet who has come into the world,' perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king." Jesus withdrew himself again to the mountain by himself. I don't know if that's something that you or me would do at that moment. Because in our sinful nature, we quite like being the center of attention. Well, not all of us, maybe, but a lot of us do, I suppose. Perhaps enjoying it while it lasts, but God makes it quite clear that he doesn't like that. Jesus told Pilate that while he was mortal and weak before God, his kingdom was not of this world. So that he had no desire to be king in a time that had no continuing city. And in this arrogant, forward, progressive, smart, and highly developed world that has forgotten God, or thinks that it doesn't need him anymore because we're so capable that we no longer depend on him, well, then do we, as God's called, want to be those proud people in a sinful world that will be done away with? Or do we want something better? Well, what does being cast out of Christ's presence mean for the unfaithful? It means, of course, not hellfire or eternal punishment, but we know it's seeing all these things like the poor man Lazarus, who was at the gate, now new and healthy, eating with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all these faithful people from the east and the west. And those proud people are watching from afar, who thought this was something that they deserved. And then Luke 19 and verse 17, our duties and the way we serve God materializes into authority, great as having that over 10 cities. Whether that's literally or not, I don't know. Romans 8 and verse 18, the sufferings of this time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that shall be revealed in us. And I think this is what brings this message across in verse 19. For creation awaits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. It's obvious, isn't it, that there's nothing more magnificent than that man will witness than the sons of God as kings and priests restoring the earth. And of course, creating a new earth that people want to be part of. That's way better than a load of men winning the Euros by really kicking a ball around, or somebody who won the F1 by turning a wheel, or Chinese politicians toasting a glass to building a megacity in a week just to tell the world they're a superpower. The sons of God performing miracles will make these things look like Lego. And that's how I look at it. And each time I hear a celebrity talk, I think to myself, well, I could be doing better things than that because God's gift offers far greater. And God willing, all of us remain faithful that by being humble now, like Christ was, we may obtain that crown of life and its blessings. Not to forget that sharing this message may help other people find their purpose amid this empty world. And now in that upper room away from the nation and just with his friends, he shares a meal and says to us as well that by remaining faithful and not to glorify ourselves in this life, we may drink of the cup new with him in his Father's kingdom. And I would have thought that sharing a cup with history's most famous man, who is real, who did rise from the dead, who is the Son of God, will stop the world turning, and the world will know all of us individually for being faithful and reaping what we have sown now. Thank you.